The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
What can be done to cushion the blow as energy bills go up by another €700? EU agree new sanctions against Russia, but who will feel the squeeze? And as Scotland moves to retain their mask mandate, how did we move? Did we move too soon in lifting ours? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, we have Eugene Murphy, Fianna Fáil Senator and Spokesperson on Community, Rural Affairs and the Islands, Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin Senator and Party Spokesperson on Climate Justice, and Michael Fitzmaurice, Independent TD for Galway Roscommon. And joining us down the line, we have Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times. We want to hear from you as well, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now to Ukraine first, and that awful news that an Irish citizen has been killed outside of Kyiv today. Jack, can you tell us more about Pierre Zakshevsky?
Yes, so he was a cameraman, I think originally born in France and moved to Ireland as a child. And he went to school in South Dublin. I believe he grew up there as well in the same area around St. Conleth's College. And he really established himself. Had a kind of storied career covering a lot of international conflicts. He seemed to be drawn quite bravely to these conflict zones and covered them as a cameraman for Fox News, obviously one of the major American networks, which is an indication of the guy's talent and commitment and capacities, covered Afghanistan amongst other conflict zones, and seemingly was involved in an incident not too dissimilar to the clip that went viral not too long ago of the Sky News camera crew and reporters coming under fire in a city in Ukraine, and was killed along with his fixer, his on the ground producer, a Ukrainian woman called Alexandra Koshino, and obviously is mourned not only by the country here, but by his colleagues who spoke very highly of him as a legend, as someone who never shied away from a challenge and has clearly left his mark on the world of journalism.
Yes, indeed. It's obviously becoming a very dangerous place to be reporting from right now, and obviously a very dangerous place to be living in. We know this evening the EU has formally approved a new range of sanctions against Russia. These include bans on investments in the energy sector and luxury goods exports and on the import of steel products from Russia. Who will feel this, Jack? Where will this hit the hardest?
Well, it's in keeping with some of the more recent interventions where we see the kind of better off in Russia, the urban dwellers, people who live in Moscow and have decent incomes, being targeted and being targeted by measures like the banning on luxury goods being imported, and also some of the heavier industries now being roped into it as well. So we see steel imports. But I think that, you know, what this stops short of doing is going near the energy space and going near the gas, the coal and the oil imports that are still flowing out of Russia. And watching the EU Affairs Committee, the Oireachtas EU Affairs Committee here today, they were hearing testimony not only from the Ukrainian ambassador to Dublin, but also from a lot of her counterparts in neighbouring countries, Poland, Moldova and others, all of whom were saying the sanctions only go so far, and they included the sanctions that were announced recently, the fourth package from Brussels. The sanctions only go so far, they are welcome, they're having an effect, but you have to go further, and they're asking the EU effectively to go further on energy imports and also to go further in terms of agitating and supporting calls for a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
Yeah, can I open this to the panel? Lynn Boylan, should we be going further with the sanctions?
Well, I know one of the things that Sinn Féin has been calling for a long time is the closing down of the tax loopholes. So the Irish Financial Services Centre and the Section 1110 loopholes, which is basically brass plate companies or shell companies where there's money funnelling through, availing of
billions, tax, we're told.
Billions, yep. And one of them in particular was a bank that's specifically set up to fund the Russian military. So, I mean, that's something that we think that Ireland should be doing. It would punish Russia, it would, you know, hit them where it hurts. But look, sanctions have to be balanced in how they impact on citizens on both sides of the dispute or the war. But I definitely think that the Irish government should be looking at those tax loopholes and closing them.
Yeah, Eugene, it seems extraordinary that, because we've been hearing about these loopholes and, you know, who's been using them and where that money might be coming from and going to for years now. And yet there seems to be a reluctance at government level to move against them.
I wouldn't say there's a reluctance, Katie. Yes, we've often heard the debate over the years, but we're now in a very serious situation with this war. And I suppose it's come more into the arena now with debate as what could be going on with these monies. But I'm sure the government are actually, you know, keeping an eye on the situation. And I've no doubt that if further action is needed, they will take it.
But late in the day, though, if these banks and these monies have been actually funding and fueling the military build-up that has landed us where we are today.
And maybe all of us should have been more aware of what Russia was up to down to the years. I accept that. But I would say at this stage that all that is being looked into and being monitored very, very closely. And I'd say if needs be, there will be action.
I'd say now that mightn't be of great comfort to the people who are having their homes bombed out from under them. Michael, do you think we are going far enough on sanctions? Do you think sanctions are an effective tool in this?
Sanctions may be an effective tool in the long term. But to be honest about it, Katie, I don't think Putin worries about sanctions at the moment because, from my understanding, he put a war chest together of about 600 billion. My understanding at the moment is that there's approximately 200 billion of that used. And he's not a guy that worries about the people in his country, to be quite frank about it, or the poverty that would be involved in it. And while sanctions down the line will actually probably affect the ordinary Russian person harder, those people like Putin, I don't think it's going to affect him like it should.
But is the idea of them that they will turn the oligarchs and the middle classes against the regime and that ultimately there may be a change of
atmosphere? If you're living in a dictatorship or communism, those people at the top that are driving the country, they don't seem to worry about that, to be quite honest with you. They live in a different planet. And we have to be careful as well of the knock-on effects. We saw, if there's any spook in the market at the moment in the line of energy, every country in Europe is at the mercy of them at the moment. We see in gas, we see today 39% of an increase. We see the likes of steel. If all those things keeps getting affected, we see oil. There was debate last weekend about a tanker coming in. Is there this tankers floating around Europe? Are we getting the oil? And if we start getting short of stuff, with trying to actually cope to help those people that are coming from war torn areas, there is a huge, huge risk of a recession in this country and right throughout Europe. And then what will you fight back at? You'll have nothing to fight back at, because we must remember that the people that are coming into every country, you'll need more resources and more facilities and more everything to help those. But on top of that, if inflation keeps going up, the risk, I have an awful fear that over the next few months, instead of a boom that we were shaping up for coming out of the pandemic, in fairness, things were looking good, that we could go into a recession. If we go into a recession, we're in deep trouble, because this time, in 2010, we had 48 billion borrowed. This year, we have 270 billion borrowed. So we won't have the facilities to go to our increase in spending like we had before.
We had Pat McDonough from you know, Supermax and the hotels and the plazas, the forecourt plazas, on with us last Saturday. He was predicting a recession, Eugene.
Yeah, and it's quite possible that's where we're heading at the moment. I mean, we're very uncertain, Katie, as to where this will go. I mean, if we can get a ceasefire and talks going, it's the best way forward. But none of us know. None of the governments know. We don't know what Putin will do next. So we're in a very uncertain situation. And, you know, I agree with Michael what he says there about sanctions. But, you know, I think the sanctions that are there are really beginning to rush hurt the Russian public. And I think every week that goes by that they're without services they were used to, I think they're going to turn more against Putin. And even that incident on Russian TV last night, I think that was an eye-opener for the world. I mean, there is distrust of him in his own country, and I think that's growing. It's a very, very, you know, it's a very hard call to say what's going to happen next. Let's be honest about it. We're very close to a war situation. The Russians, you know, launched a missile very close to the Polish border a few days ago. You know, if one of those missiles landed in some of the other countries, you know, this is quite serious at the moment.
What's worrying?
Let Jack in. You don't have your headphones, but Jack is trying to get in there. Sorry, Mick. Jack?
Yeah, no, just wanted to respond to something Eugene said. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that the sanctions might undercut support either amongst elites in and around the Kremlin or amongst, you know, the Russian man or woman in the street, I think that that's a hopeful idea. I wonder whether it's a likely idea. You know, I think that to a certain extent, we underestimate the nature of Russian society and how it works, how the news media works, notwithstanding the very brave intervention that we all saw last night taking place on Russian television. You know, I was, you know, reading into this in recent days and listening to podcasts about it, and it's quite scary the degree to which it is a totalitarian society at this stage, and, you know, the degree to which there is no discussion of the war in the terms that we would discuss it in Ireland or elsewhere on Russian media. You know, there is no sense of this country being at war, and there is no opposition to speak of. So while I think it's seductive and attractive, and everyone hopes that, you know, this may end up in a situation where the regime of Vladimir Putin comes crumbling down around him, I think that A, if that happens, it won't be quick and easy and simple. And B, I'm just not sure how likely it is to happen at all. I think that a much more likely outcome is that, you know, he hangs on, he continues this this horrible, corrosive war in Ukraine in some way, shape or form, and Russia gets embedded into a long-running economic war with the West, where you have these, I mean, sanctions is almost a misnomer. These are hugely powerful economic weapons that are being used against Russia, and you have those being used for periods of months, if not years, and that's a massively destabilizing thing for the region and for the global economy to deal with.
Yes, and of course, then there's the big questions about where China will land in all of this. Mick, you were trying to get in there.
There's a few things. There's certainly a counter response from him. If you look at the planes, the leasing companies in Ireland, they're in serious trouble with what's gone on with he brought in legislation. But what I'm at a loss to know or see is that with all the leaders around Europe and around the world, and there's one name that would probably come to mind, like Angela Merkel, how some group, or be it Europe or be it some other part of the world, hasn't tried to promote somebody to try and bring a peaceful, or try and bring the parties together.
But Macron been playing that role?
Yeah, but look, Macron is running around the place, and he's not the person that I think would be the solvent of. The likes of Angela Merkel would have met Putin many times before. She comes from East Germany, and I think that she's the type of a person that's sort of out of politics but still in it, that could be a person that could go in and try and negotiate to try and find a resolution to it. Because a resolution needs to be found to this. And on top of this, like, as long as Putin goes, no matter, when you go into a country...
But is the difficulty now, though, there is no political win that can be seen for Putin. Whatever, you know, whatever that he thought was going to happen at the start of this, there is no fast military win. But even if there was a military win here, there's no political endgame that you can see.
I think he's underestimated both his military strategy, and I was listening to Tony Connolly talking on the news earlier and saying, you know, that he would have thought that he would have been in and out and the government would have collapsed within days. And do you mean you can only assume that they're shocked that that hasn't happened and the resistance that they're meeting? But I don't think he also would have anticipated the level of sanctions and the united front internationally from a lot of countries coming together. Like, when you're seeing the yachts being seized, the sanctions that are coming down, you're seeing European countries changing their energy policies overnight. All of those measures, I think he wouldn't have expected to happen so quickly and from so many different quarters. And I disagree, as was with Jack, in that I do think that the oligarchs when they're seeing their yachts being seized, when their football clubs are being sold, I think that they will hold some leverage over Putin, because I mean the whole point of the oligarchs was, you know, you let us accumulate the money,
it was the money game,
and we stay out of your politics.
Yeah.
And now the politics is coming into to their.
There's only one thing, Lynn, is that in said that the Russian war, the way the fighter war, and I don't know, I didn't hear Tony Connolly this evening, but if you watch what they've done down through the years, the old style Russian war, what they do is they encircle an area, they bombard it. And they just sit and wait. And what they try and do is starve the people to give up in the area. And
no, that's what they're doing in Mariupol. Yeah,
and that's what they're doing. But this is what they always do.
But you have Russian army conscripts who thought they were being sent in on training missions. You know, yeah. So all of that is feeding back.
I think, look,
Eugene.
I have no doubt that, you know, a lot of the reports coming out about the war, they're at one and one thing, that the Russian army has not got its way. We're at what, day 20? And there's no sign of descending. And you're right when you say that, Lynn, that, you know, Putin had this plan to get in and out in maybe 8 or 10 days. That's not happened. And you see them calling for help from China, which is a serious development. If that's true or not, I hope it's not. But I do think that, you know, they're being really hit financially from every part of the world. Their currency is in trouble. You know, a lot of the services that people were used to, their Western services they got used to, are gone. And I think that is going to cause some major problems on the ground every day and every week that goes by. So I'm not so sure that those, you know, those particular sanctions that are there now aren't going to have a major effect on him.
What about our response here then, if we move on to that? First of all, the humanitarian response. Are we doing enough? I want. Can you tell me about that great project you were writing about on the Facebook in Newbridge and Galway?
But first of all, to answer the first part of your question, if you saw, and Eugene had seen, and probably Lynn sees it, on the ground out the country, the amount of work that's been done by ordinary people in every little village, in a small way, be it putting stuff together to send out to Ukraine, be it getting a room ready, or as I saw myself the weekend in the Newbridge and Ballygare area, where there was a school closed for 11 years, and they went at it Friday evening, and they wired it, done the heating in it. There was 50 people there last Saturday, and on Sunday, I was up there Sunday, and there was 53 or 4 between women, teenagers and children, and they washed every wall, and they painted every piece of that school, and they have it basically ready. And in the surrounding areas, be it Ballygare, and Eugene would know all these areas, and Mount Bellew and all the areas around it, the amount of houses that are, you know, willing to help out, and they're creating their own hub that they'll have internet. You know, they have teachers lined up that are retired to teach English, and the amount of work that's been done on the ground, I think. You know, there's 20,000, I think, at the moment is what we're hearing, or 22,000. There is a problem, in my opinion, that the likes of the Red Cross wouldn't have enough of resources or maybe people at the moment to try and handle all of this. And, you know, there is reports in media about, I heard it earlier on, you know, one of the media outlets wrote that someone in some county was putting up with things, a room for if you...
Or in exchange
or
for sex, yeah.
But that's listen, it's sad to see that sometimes the press don't hone in on the 99.999% of people that's out there on the ground.
To be fair now, Michael, we've had pages and pages and you know, report after report on every media outlet about the great work
In my opinion... there's ferocious work being done. There is people coming into this country that governments don't even know about at the moment. We need to make sure the wraparound service are put there. That will be a challenge, in my opinion. The Red Cross, I think, is under pressure, but it will be a huge challenge to make sure that, be it the psychological services, be it that the school services... And you'll also need interpreters and all of that to help them.
I mean, that's going to be a huge issue. I mean, psychological services. We know that people are crying out for psychological services for children here for years. And there's waiting lists and there's, you know, waits for assessment and all that. How are we going to magic up, you know, all these supports for, you know, what would possibly be very traumatised children arriving here from, you know, very difficult situations.
No, absolutely. And what we need is sort of a two-pronged approach. The first is the emergency reaction, which is people arriving, getting them into emergency accommodation, whether that's in hotels or with the public coming forward and offering up rooms. But that's not a long-term solution. And we've seen the damage that's done on families who are homeless living in hotels for years. So that's not the long-term. What we need to hear from the government is what's their plan for the long-term? How are we going to house them? How are we going to find the school spaces? How are we going to resource the health service to deal with all of the needs that will come with bringing in such a large volume of people in one go? And what's, I suppose, really frightening at the moment is that I know that Owen O'Brien wrote to Dara O'Brien, Kathleen Funchen wrote to Roderick Gorman, and Pa Daly wrote to Helen McEntee, and kind of asking for that plan. And the response certainly from Dara O'Brien around it was that this is Roderick O'Gorman's problem. And, you know, he's the line manager on this. We need an all of government approach, and we have to be to manage this very, very carefully, because these are people who are fleeing a war, who of course are going to come with all of the psychological issues that that'll bring with them, and they need all of the support. But equally, we currently have a housing crisis and we have a health crisis, and how are we going to manage all of that? So I think we need a pandemic style approach to how we address this.
It's interesting actually that Lynn says about the pandemic style approach and the kind of little bit of past the parcel that might be going on, because it reminds me of when the government sought to launch mandatory hotel quarantine last year, and there was that kind of not me gov attitude between different government departments, Justice pointing at Health, who pointed at Transport when it came to the nitty gritty of how we were going to implement this thing. The difference here is that, you know, mandatory hotel quarantine was a somewhat limited system set up against the backdrop where not a huge amount of people were really moving around or coming into the country. I think what's slightly lost, or what's, if not lost, it's hard to almost conceive of the scale of what's coming. You know, this is an influx of refugees rightly seeking protection in Ireland of a scale in a time period that I don't think we've ever been confronted with before. I mean, it's just reporting out some of the trends that are emerging in the hotel system at the moment. Last week, there was between 100 and 250 people per day arriving into Ireland from Ukraine and seeking accommodation, who then had to be put up in hotels. Over the weekend and into the first part of this week, that jumped up to between 300 and 450 people per day, because the profile of person who's now coming into Ireland has changed from someone who might have a family member here or some sort of social support network here to someone who has nothing and needs to be supported by the state.
And indeed, I heard Jack, the Ukrainian ambassador, say today that the word that we have dropped visa requirements for people coming from Ukraine might not have really been generally gotten through to the population in Ukraine, and that if that happens, that we could see a massive increase in the number of people arriving here.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, everything is going to be filtered, as I understand it, through this EU redistributive mechanism, whereby it's done on the basis of your head of population, the overall percentage of the European population that you account for, and will get. I think the rough guide is about 20,000 refugees for every 1 million that flee Ukraine, but they're talking about 5 million people fleeing Ukraine. So that's obviously an enormous influx. And as other contributors have already outlined, that's going to present a huge challenge for social services, and it's going to present a demand on the exchequer of the order of hundreds of millions of euros that will come in alongside other demands in the exchequer, which arise from having to, in some way, to some extent, defray the impact on cost of living that was already there as a secular trend and has been driven to kind of nosebleed heights by the war in Ukraine.
Indeed, yeah. I'm just looking at a text we've got in here, Eugene. How are we going to give healthcare, dentists and housing to up to 100,000 extra people on medical cards? I can't find a property to rent. I can't get a doctor or a dentist in my area.
Well, first of all, Katie, can I say, I just want to react to what both speakers have said here. And it is true, the response of the Irish people has been phenomenal up and down the country. And I was just checking on figures for Roscommon recently. Over 400 people have offered accommodation, and that's out of a population of 64,000 people. That's phenomenal in a county that size. And of course, I think the primrose of blue of Roscommon is really identifying with the primrose and blue of the Ukraine. Now, I just am of the opinion, and hopefully, that this war won't last as long as maybe some people think. And if it doesn't, we will not have the influx of 100,000 people. But one way or the other, I think in the short term, we are going to have 20, 30, maybe 40,000 people on our doorsteps. And we have to try and help them. But I do believe that, to be honest, people are going to do everything in their powers to help those people. Several schools have been on to me, you know, families have been on to me. And that really is the only way we can take this. We have to have the will to do it. And we either back the Ukrainian people or we don't. And I want to back them, and most Irish people want to back them. So it's a challenge, and I think the Irish people will rise to the challenge, and I think the government will rise to the challenge.
I know, just but Eugene, what, honest to God now.
But can I say one thing?
No, and everyone is of all goodwill and everything, but that tweeter is right. We haven't been able to put roofs over the heads of our own people here for the last decade. And we can't find doctors. People can't get GP appointments. There's weeks of delay. Where are we going to magic up all these services for people who are going to be in dire need of some of these services?
Look, we all have to accept we've had that issue with housing. There's no doubt about that. But I do believe in this crisis, we have to try and help the Ukrainian people. Now, in the short term, hotels, you know, have said they will help out. That short term. Mike spoke about an old school being done up. There's a huge amount of work going out there at the moment to try and, in the short term, look after those people. And I genuinely think that will happen. I think Ireland want to do this and they will do it. Now, we have a plan for housing. It's going to work. It's going to take a little while to work. I accept that it's very hard for some people to understand, you know, bringing in people and housing them when we can't supply houses for all of our own people. Look, that is an emergency, but this is real trouble for people in the world. Our friends in Eastern Europe were either with them or against them. And I just want to make one final point. It's not true to say that there isn't, you know, government ministers pulling together, because I know for a fact, talking to people like Heather Humphreys, Dara Bryan, Roderick O'Gorman, Helen McEntee, all Norma Foley, they're all coordinating together. And by the way, I heard, I don't know, was it on Claire Byrne's show or Drive Time, several Ukrainians who were interviewed about their experience coming into the country, and they were full of praise as to how they were handled at Dublin Airport. So I think we'll do it. And I think people are determined to do it, and government have to give the supports to do it.
Okay, let's move on to the other pressing issue, well, linked issue, I suppose we should call it. This is the cost of living, and the news today from Bord Gáis that they're putting up price about 27% electricity for electricity and 39% for gas. And I see just this evening, Pascal Donoghue has told Virgin Media News that the government has no plans to introduce further measures to aid the cost of living before the next budget. So that's, what do we say, something like €700 increase on top of the massive increases that people have already taken on board in the run-up to Christmas. It's just, it's kind of almost incomprehensible how people are going to find this, particularly anybody on a fixed income.
No, absolutely. And like every year as it is, before you saw these price hikes, we have people who are dying early in life because of fuel poverty. And that's the reality. And we're having children whose entire life is affected because they're growing up in, you know, poorly ventilated and cold homes. So we've had a huge issue around fuel poverty before this crisis kicked in. What we need, and again, it's a little bit like how you address the refugees coming in, is that you have to have the short-term measures to ease the pain for people, but then you have to have the long-term. How do we wean ourselves off in terms of the oil and gas and coal and make sure that we have that energy security? How do we retrofit the homes? You know, so I suppose from Sinn Féin's point of view, we have put forward the cost of living proposals. One of them, of course, was about that €15 million discretionary fund, you know, that would help people who aren't eligible for the fuel allowance to access money just to help them out with their bills. But equally, like, I've been calling for the energy poverty strategy for the last 2 years. It lapsed in 2019. So we don't even have a strategy before this crisis as to how do we identify those households who we should be targeting to help with the measures. So we need that, again, that thought out approach. How do we help people now in the short term? And how are we going to ensure that we actually reduce fuel poverty in the long term?
Michael Fitzmaurice, you think we should go back to cutting and foot and turf?
Well, I think that if this war continues and if petrol and diesel and home heating oil keeps going up, one time ago, I think in the last war, when they were doing the LIDAR system or checking there a few years ago, they went over the Phoenix Park and turf turned up in it. Did you ever know that? Where the people of the countryside sent turf to Dublin to help them years ago. In my opinion, for the people in the rural areas that might have a stove or whatever, there's the likes of Bournemouth that has vast areas of bog should be made available if they want to use it. There is a serious problem at the moment of people heating their homes. And what I cannot understand in this, I asked the question on Leaders' Questions about a month ago, 6 weeks ago from the Taoiseach there, was the Ukrainian crisis going to affect the people in Ireland in relation to gas? And what I was told was 70% of our gas comes from Mayo, and that 30% of it comes from Scotland, and that we were in no way being affected. But it's like any good circus when it's going around town, everyone wants to go to it. And what seems to be happening, there's a lot of gouging going on as well, being honest with you, that why is the gas in Mayo costing all this extra money because Putin or someone else put up the price of gas?
Or because there's a wholesale gas price.
Well, yeah, but why is that?
Because it's an internationally traded commodity,
well,
right?
It's an internationally traded commodity, but we are leaving ourselves wide open. We have gone down the road, basically, to put a very, very, and Europe has a lot of the, in my opinion, a lot of the fault of this. We've relied on Putin for 40% of gas in Europe. We're relying on oil. We don't want to do the word anything that's dirty. We're going to get rid of it. Here in Ireland, we weren't even going to go letting anyone explore. And now we're coming...
Because we're in a climate emergency.
Pardon?
Because we're in a climate emergency.
We're in a poverty emergency at the moment in relation to food and in relation to energy. So which would you address first? If someone is going to get perished next week, whether the world is going to end in 20 or 30 years, that's not going to matter to them if the day of the
but
coal
sure,
next
you're
week.
Opening the bog isn't going to do anything in the short term either.
Do you know what
because
fire
you have
is?
To get, you have to get an environmental impact assessment first of all.
Why?
Turf would have to be harvested and would have to be dried.
Why would you have to get an environmental impact?
Are you another
person that believes everything Europe tells you? You should do it.
Michael, we need to move away.
Sinn Féin now gone pro-Europe.
We need to move away from fossil fuels. And if anything has shown us, we're in a climate emergency, but we're now staring it right in the face about how important it is to be energy secure.
How long will it take?
And Ireland is in a unique position.
How long will it take?
Well, it will take, that's what I'm saying, you have short-term reliefs to ease the burden for people now.
10 years for wind turbines offshore.
You have targeted measures, 5 to 10 years, yeah. Michael.
So what's going to keep the fires going next week, next month? For the next 6 months. That's what I'm asking.
You're talking about asking about things that aren't actually possible. You're giving
false hope
to people.
We were told one time ago, Lynn, that it wasn't possible to cut our own bogs. We cut them. And I'll tell you one thing, we're still here to tell the tale.
You'll be underwater.
I think there's a political reality at work here as well, though, which is that, you know, a lot of the measures that are being proposed there, and indeed measures that Sinn Féin have proposed around the carbon tax and increases there, they're just not... They're not politically acceptable to one of the partners in government, which is the Green Party. So I don't think that any of them can be put in place without risking the survival of the coalition. So, like, I mean, you know, Michael is not alone in opposition to some of these things, and we've seen calls from both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil backbenchers in the parliamentary party meetings over the last couple of weeks to stall the increases in the carbon tax. I don't think that's going to happen because it would endanger the future of the government. The Green Party would threaten to pull the plug. So that's the political backdrop. That's the political reality we live in. So notwithstanding what Pascal Donoghue said this morning about, you know, his belief that the government might be able to make it all the way to the budget without further interventions to help people out and defray these costs further, I think that that's a more likely thing to happen, that if these inflationary pressures are maintained, that the Exchequer will be asked to step up again, and they'd be following through on a new kind of doctrine that they've created in the last little while around which has its roots in COVID policy, really, but which is that, you know, when confronted by big shocks, big economic shocks or big social shocks, the government will step in with spending or forego tax revenues in order to try and kind of cushion that to some extent.
Yeah.
What he's also said, though, is that it's impossible to cushion it entirely, and, you know, no one should expect to escape the increases in cost of living that are coming down the tracks.
Eugene, can I ask you, what do you believe Pascal Dunne when he says he doesn't expect to be going back to the well to give us some more comfort between now and the budget?
Well, I'll answer that in a moment to Katie, but I think, in fairness, the government have been doing something to try and help hard-pressed consumers out there. And, I mean, I do accept now with the new increases, it doesn't seem much. But, I mean, the fuel allowance this country has paid out to close to 400,000 people. That was expanded in the last budget. It's now about 1,000 per year. It's risen quite a lot. And we have the start payment of 125 max from last Monday. So that should be taken into account. Also, the excise duty reduction is costing 320 million euro. So look, I know it's... We probably will
but
have.
Should we know in the excise duty case? Do we know that was gone? It was gone before it came out, well, because the wholesale price went up a few days beforehand. We know that people are paid 1,000 euro more for a fill of oil last year. So the fuel allowance is.
And I've made the point, and I was one of the people at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party that raised the issue of the gouging that was going on, and there was gouging going on in relation to our fuel prices. Now more does need to be done, and I do think the minister and the government will have to go back.
But remember
what they are trying.
Do you think
he
should go back?
I think that what we're trying to do is get Europe to act on the VAT. Europe to act on the
Europe back. Europe has produced a toolkit for governments, and you're not even availing of all of that.
Lynn.
There was a windfall tax was introduced in Spain back in September 2021. Lynn. We know that ESB have made, I think they're going to make about 700 million in profit in 2022. Energia had a 48% increase in profits. And Bord Gáis, okay, their profits went down, but a lot of that was to do with the fact that Whitegate wasn't up and running. So there are tools that can be used. The same with the regulator. Minister Ryan could sort of dictate to the regulator that they need to take a more proactive approach in the market so they can put caps on the tariffs. So we've seen today with the insurance companies that the loyalty tariff is now a thing of the past. The same thing happens with your energy company. If you don't shift, you get put onto a higher tariff. And there are lots of people out there who can't shop around, can't shift because they either have a poor credit rating, they don't have the capacity themselves. And the CRU could be set up as a one-stop shop to help people do that as well. The prepay meters, which are used by families who are really at the pin of their collar and are desperate to not go into debt. The CRU basically told the Climate Committee that they're paying for a premium product. They're not paying for a premium product. They're paying for a product that will help them from falling into debt. So the energy regulator can actually regulate some of the tariffs. And we need Minister Ryan to basically tell them to do that.
Look, you came from your party in Northern Ireland led to the collapse of an administration with the DUP, and you haven't really done much for people in relation to electricity.
We've repeatedly called for the DUP to nominate a first minister so we can actually agree a budget to help people.
Look, repeatedly calling for something isn't action. The government are acting, and even today I know the government had a conference call where they further discussed these increases that were announced today.
Now, do you think people on prepaid meters are paying for prepaid?
Let Eugene respond.
Piers Doherty was on two radio stations. He was on Cormac and this evening on the radio. He was on another national station as well. And he proposed cuts of 1.2 billion. And on numerous occasions, he was asked, where would the money come from? He could only add it up to 600 million. So there's not much in what you're proposing. There's a lot of talk, there's a lot of spin, but there's no action in it.
I just gave you three examples of things that wouldn't cost revenue at all.
Finish your point very quickly and then you can respond.
A government has to act. It's a job of opposition, I accept, you know, to make proposals, but the criticism should be, you know, just criticism. Now, I believe that the government are acting, they are mounting this situation, there will be further action, and I hope that the EU will take action to further reduce the VAT on fuel. That is the way forward for people at the moment.
Very quickly, because I've got somebody on the line.
There will be more action from the government on
this. The EU have called for the tariff caps. We have not chosen not to do that. They've called for windfall taxes. We're not looking at that. So there are lots of things from other jurisdictions that we could do that actually wouldn't cost money.
I want to go to Paul Mooney now, because obviously a lot of these issues are particularly felt in rural Ireland, in particular, cost of diesel, cost of fertiliser. We're now talking about fodder and food security. Paul Mooney is the property editor with the Irish Farmers Journal. Tomorrow, the Farmers Journal has its county by county land price report. And when we saw what was coming out of that, we decided to have you on, Paul, because what it's showing is really quite startling, isn't it?
Certainly, Katie, yes. Last year, another big increase in the average price of farmland around the country. In most counties, average price increased. And looking at national figures, the average price rose by 16% on the previous year. So quite a significant increase.
And that would bring it up to 33% increase since 2019?
In 2 years, absolutely. Yeah. Bring the average price of farmland very close to €12,000 per acre. It's a familiar story, Katie. It's, you know, very strong demand for farmland right around the country, and supply of farmland coming for sale last year down. So the inevitable result then is an increase in average price.
And why is there such a demand for farmland right now?
Katie, there's demand, first of all, from farmers, and particularly from dairy farmers. The enterprise is profitable, as we all know, and they're looking to expand. Other farmers are keen to get into dairying as well, into milk. And as well as that, then there is a huge demand from a broad business category of buyer, which would include everybody from investors with very little connection to the land, who might see, already have other property and possibly shareholdings, for example, and would see farmland as a nice, safe way of diversifying the portfolio a little bit. And then you would have, you know, rural-based business people who are very familiar and comfortable with the idea of owning farmland and like to own a bit as well. And then you would have many, many part-time farmers, Katie, who'd have a good job, whether it's in tech or whatever, good job, a good off-farm income, and they're also very keen to buy more farmland.
What will all of this mean? I mean, if it continues in this trajectory, what will this mean for the future of farming?
Katie, we're certainly obviously in a time of uncertainty now compared to 12 months ago, for all the reasons you've been talking about there with the panel, food security as well. But the pressures and the forces that led to prices increasing in 2021, Katie, are really still there. You know, farmers are keen to expand. Farmers are looking now, certainly concerns about high fertilizer prices, for example, and high fuel prices there, like everybody else in society. But they're also wondering, will there be a new focus now on food security, and will that maybe, you know, reward them more for farming, expanding their farms, for example? So we just don't quite know what that will do, for example, to demand for farmland in this year and next year. But I take your point. I take the point that you're coming to there, which is that the price of farmland now is being driven certainly by external forces and by people not directly involved in farming, and it does make it more difficult for young people, say, starting off in farming, to either acquire land or to expand their farms.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, many, many thanks for that exclusive, and we can read all about that in tomorrow's Farmers Journal if you want to get the breakdown from your own county. It'll all be laid out there. Michael, what do you read from that?
First of all, in the line of farming, there isn't, as Paul rightly pointed out, that much land coming up. And especially in the dairy sector, there was expansion. But also, Katie, for people, what we'd say, the people that had money, business people that had money, if they had it in a bank, it'd actually be costing them having the money in the bank. So what they're doing is they're putting it into the farm, they're renting it out or whatever, and they're getting a return over a number of years and hopefully down the road. The one worry I have, that especially
is
with
this the financialization of farmland, yeah, agricultural land, the same as we had with
it's not the ordinary beef or sheep farmer that's given this big money. And the big worry I have is that down the road, if you did see a recession coming, or there was, say, if beef prices slipped or if dairy prices slipped, and especially in line with fertilizer prices at the moment, fertilizer has gone up 250%. I was bought last year at €400, €1,000, and actually today most co-ops were told to suspend fertiliser sales. Today. Yeah, around the country. And if you look at diesel prices, the high, say the percentage-wise where land was going fairly extreme, I think is going to start coming, you know, will start steadying up a bit for the simple reason there's an awful fear in the farming community out there at the moment that the input costs are going so high. I listened to farmers and I heard all these environmentalists talk, and I even saw a thing coming out tonight about the amount of emissions that are coming out that agriculture put up. But with fertiliser at the price it's at, I can see at the moment certain farmers, they're not going to put out the fertiliser. They're going to cut down on a lot of stock. Next September, you will see, in my opinion, a lot of stock coming out that won't be replaced, because they're going to cut down on numbers because they can't afford to buy the fertiliser. And you will see a certain amount of diversification. I know there's a new scheme going
to
come
out. So will we see the national herd begin to drop because
of
this?
I was very much opposed to any of that. I don't mind if someone makes the decision themselves to go up or go down, but I don't want it inflicted on them. But what you will see as well is that there probably is a realisation coming that in certain parts of the country, with, I think the government are putting a package together at the moment in the line of sowing certain crops, that we need, you know, to get probably a bit more sustainable in what we can grow. And let's be honest about it. There's a problem there at the moment that with fertilizer prices, you have to have fertilizer to grow the crops. And if it's gone at the moment, that's a problem. But on top of that, there are certain parts of the country that's good at growing stuff and certain parts not. But the Irish people has also to make decisions. We see in North Dublin.
I'm going to stop you because...
The likes of the vegetable areas.
Yeah.
And they went out of business because something came in from some other country cheap. If it's not coming in now, and we have it last, where do we go?
Indeed. I'm going to come to you in one moment. I'm going to take a quick break, but hold that thought because I want to get your response to that.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannon on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, sorry, I stopped you when you were about to jump in there in response to what Michael was saying. Lynn?
Yeah, no, I think, look, the issue around the inputs for farming, and while it mightn't suit all farmers, I do think where we're falling down as a country is around the organics, and that would reduce the inputs. We have very low ambition, and while it's increased under the new government, it's still very low compared to our EU counterparts. And even in today's independent farming supplement, I was reading about how Denmark are the leaders on this, and the reason for that is that not only did they incentivise farmers to go down that road, but they promised them the market. So a little bit like what they did in terms of the dairy industry here, the Danes basically promised farmers, if you go down this road and go into organic, we will promise you the market. One way they did it was they mandated all supermarkets over a certain size had to have a percentage of organic goods, and it created the market for the Danish goods. So I think that's one area. It's not going to fix all of the problems, but it's certainly something we could be looking at. The other thing, and again, in the farming supplement today, I think it was Darren McCullough was talking about the importance of generating the renewable energy, and farming communities and community centres and schools all being part of the energy transition. And we need to have that microgeneration bill brought forward as soon as possible. And farmers need to be able to have solar panels and feed into the grid and generate an income for doing that.
Yeah.
Well, I'd just say, look, I agree with a lot of what Michael and Lynn have said there. Just to say that I would be concerned that smaller farmers, you know, with the high costs and all that now, you know, would say to themselves, look, we're going to get out of this. And that would be a bad thing. I think I'm very confident that Charlie McConnell is coming with a package. He has been in consultation with the farming groups. I think there would be support there. If you want farmers to...
Do you think the farming groups were that thrilled now after their meeting last week?
No, I think that was the initial meeting. I think things have moved on from that, and I hope they have. I came from a horticultural background myself, and the constantly importation of so much veg, so much fruit into this country. Now, some fruit you can't grow here, I accept that.
But I understand that there is only 100 horticultural outfits left in this country.
Very few. And that's a pity, and that's an area that I know the government have a plan for it, but we do need to give more support to the horticultural sector, and we do need to grow more. But in order to do that, you have to give the right support to farmers, and I'm confident that Charlie McConnell is coming forward with a good package. And time is of the essence here. We have to move quickly.
Okay, speaking of moving quickly, I'm looking at the clock, and I want to get in about COVID, because I think if anybody's paying any attention around them, it seems that everybody you meet has COVID in their house or in their extended family at the moment. Today, the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, decided to delay lifting the legal requirement to wear a mask on public transport in Scotland and in other settings. She said, you know, it was supposed to be lifted next Monday, but she said it was prudent to keep the measure in place because of the current spike in COVID cases. Did we lift our mandate too soon?
Well, I suppose whether we lifted it too soon or not, I think the issue is that I would be encouraging people to continue to wear the masks because while it's not legally mandated, I still think it's the right thing to do, especially when you're on public transport or you're in the supermarket or in your crowded spaces.
But should it be legally mandated in places like public transport in particular?
I'm not sure you can go back down that road, like once the genie's out of the bottle, but certainly I'm wearing the mask everywhere I go. I would call on everybody, but I also think we need to be encouraging people to get their boosters and to have the uptake on the vaccinations. From anyone I'm speaking to, they're picking up COVID predominantly from school children. So, you know, we know we have a low uptake on the 5 to 11 year olds. So I think if parents have concerns, I would encourage them to speak to your GP, speak to the HSE and get the children vaccinated and try and reduce it that way.
Michael. Thankfully, Katie, I looked at the figures today and I was looking at them yesterday. There's, and I know it might be 42 too many, but there's 42, I think, in ICU at the moment. There was 41, I think, yesterday. And thankfully, a lot of people are getting through it that get it. Yeah, it is, there's a bigger figure. But at the end of the day, you said, like, should we lift this or should we not lift it? The government, in fairness to them, they went on medical advice and there were, we had a team, there was a team there telling them step by step what to do. If they went on their own, they were going to be kicked around the place if something went wrong. And when they took the advice, now the questions are happening again. I think that somebody that's vulnerable or, say, compromised, if it's to make a decision themselves to wear the mask, yes, it's more rampant than it was, but I think it could be a spike that might ease off again because people will actually sort of, the war took over. And everyone forgot about it.
I know, but
and
we're facing into Patrick's Day weekend. We know there's going to be a lot of people in pubs, a lot of people at parties. We've got Cheltenham. You know, we're going to have all those tens of thousands of people coming back to us again. Like we could be in very serious trouble next week or the week after, could we not, Eugene?
Well, we could be, but I still don't think we should go back to, you know, insisting people wear masks. Now, I, an odd time, hop on a bus or a train here in Dublin. Mostly I go by foot. And, you know, there are quite a lot of people wearing masks. I wear a mask myself when I'm on a public transport, when I'm in a supermarket, when there's a crowd. I will do that and I will continue to do it. But I think we should note that while the figures going to hospital have increased to over 1,000, many of them actually didn't go in with COVID.
Yeah.
It was with other complaints and other ailments. And obviously you're tested for COVID when you go in there and they found they had COVID. So, you know, I think we have to take that into account as well. And thankfully, the numbers are staying very low in terms of ICU. But I would say to everybody, we're coming into a very busy weekend. Just be careful. You know, wear your mask and wash the hands. I'd say that, and we should maybe have another public campaign on that.
Well, it's interesting from the perspective of, you know, the whole pandemic, when you take a step back, the challenge that's been presented by COVID has always changed. And the way in which we've managed it has kind of changed subtly at different times over the last, when that is fully now 2 years. And I think Christmas was kind of about, can we get through a big wave of COVID infection without going into a full-scale lockdown? And I think at times it felt like we almost were in a full-scale lockdown. People locked themselves down to some extent. But when you look back at it, actually, you know, bars and restaurants were open, households were allowed to mix. It was curtailed, but it wasn't locked down. Mm. What I think is coming down the tracks is, can we get through a wave with just behavioural changes, with no non-pharmaceutical interventions introduced? Because as someone else said, you know, I don't think there's any going back this road at this stage. I'm not sure that there's an appetite or even a capacity or interest in at a population level in reintroducing a lot of the legislation around mask wearing, which has already lapsed, or certainly not reintroducing any of the restrictions that we lived with for so long, you know. So I think that this is the litmus test of navigating a wave of COVID with no restrictions. Can we take it on ourselves, on our own shoulders, and muddle through?
Okay, and I suppose it remains to be seen, as we say, if the fallout from the next couple of weeks makes a dent in that. I have to take my last break, Mike.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that's all we have time for tonight, Mike. I'm sorry, I know we were going to raise the road bridge receivership. Mm. It's a huge issue for an awful lot of people, and indeed
there's one thing I think that is coming down the tracks very rapid to us. With inflation the way it's gone, a lot of companies, even for the roads to be teared in every county, the budget that they get, they're not tindering at the moment. And we're going to see more casualties, Katie, if there isn't the likes of surcharges and all that allowable on contracts, because what they're doing now, they're walking away from contracts, and this is going to be a major crash for more than one company, unfortunately, coming down the line.
Okay, we'll get back to that. It's an issue that will indeed take our time again, unfortunately. But that's all the time we have this evening. Sean Maron was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Andrew Fleming. Lee Mullen was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by the series producer, Penny Hart. Colin Murray is on the way with Late Date. But first, I'll hand you over to Sean Dawson on the Sports Desk.